spot, so we will get started. We're glad to be back in person. It's been a while since we've been out here to share updates, so really glad to be able to do so today, and as well for the people that are able to join us online. Glad to be able to communicate with you that way. Just to give a quick round of introductions, who's here to share out information and answer questions. We've got a list here. First, we've got Kristen Seeger. She's the Program Director for the Mediation and Development Program. Myself, I'm Alyssa Selwood. I'm the project manager doing a lot of the day-to-day work on projects in the area. We also have Kyle Burton, who works in our drinking water and groundwater programs. Heidi is here from our water quality program, and we also have Nathan from the Department of Health Services. And online, we have Dean and Jody. They are going to be hosting the Zoom portion of that. So saying that out loud here, so if you are joining us online and you have questions or comments, raise your hand. They're going to be monitoring the chat and able to chime in and communicate with us over the speakers here today. So if you're joining us that way, that would be just making sure that you can communicate with us here. So, quick cover of what our agenda will be. This is a format that's going to be similar to how we've done things in the past. We'll start off with sharing out some presentation of information. First, we'll hear from Nathan with some updates on some of the PFAS health guidelines. And then I'll jump back in and provide some updates where we're at on the impact of private wells and delivery of safe water there. And then some updates on where things are at in the overall kind of investigation and process. And then from there, we'll turn it over to Q&A. So we can hear from you as well as comments, questions, concerns you might have. Did want to mention that we received good questions ahead of time, which we really appreciate. So we tried to weave some of the answers and into the content of the presentation. Haven't done so, we'll try to tee those up and keep them during the question and answer session. So some things woven into the presentation and some things we'll address later on. So at this point, PFAS I think is familiar to most people, but since we haven't been here in a while and every now and then we get some new faces, want to make sure that we're all talking point here as to what PFAS is. And so this is per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. And a key thing to take away here is these are human-made chemicals, and they're very resistant to breaking down, which is often sometimes people call them forever chemicals. Once they're out in the world, they're hard to break down. And those hard-to-break-down properties are why they were made. They were used for things like steam resistance, water repellent, things in food packaging, as well as Teflon pans, and as well as in certain firefighting foams. And so in this case, the firefighting foam aspect is really the primary driver of what most of the contamination that we're going to be talking about today is. It's that source of where PFAS came from. So that's a very basic level, but just making sure everyone starts asking questions here. And just put a link at the bottom and send it to you. You can go start at least from our HTML web page in search of PFAS, and that's a good landing spot to learn a little bit more, and it can direct you to some other resources that can help you. So, get into the meat of things where there's some real updates. So, first we're going to hear from Nathan.
Hi everyone, thanks for being here today. My name is Nathan Paco. I am a health assessor in the hazard assessment section at the Department of Health Services. Today I'll be giving an update on a handful of different PFAS-based health guidelines, both in drinking water and other biota that we might come across, wildlife, fish. Before we dig into these updates, I just want to start with a high-level overview of why it is we care about PFAS, why it's a problem that we are being exposed to it. There are many PFAS. There are thousands of them. All the research that has been done has shown that there are a lot of, there's a similar suite of health effects that they all tend to cause. We know that many of them increase cholesterol. Some have been found to decrease how well our body responds to vaccines, how well our immune response is. Some have been shown to cause liver damage. Two PFAS, one especially, PFOA, has been identified as a carcinogen, primarily kidney and testicular. Another PFOS is a probable carcinogen. They have been, some have been shown to modulate the thyroid hormone signaling system in the body. And there are also a number that have been found to have impacts on a number of developmental related things, both for the child with lower birth weight and associations with pregnancy-related hypertension and preeclampsia. So again, not every PFAS has been found to be associated with every single health effect, but since they often occur in mixtures in nature, this sort of suite has is why we care about this. And is why we're continuing to study and work on it. A lot of recent work, both on the federal and state level, has continued to find that these health effects have been happening at lower levels than we initially thought. So as a result of that, we have been going into update. We have been working on updating our health guidelines for drinking water and groundwater. So earlier this year, back in February, we sent a letter of our recommendations for new groundwater standards to the DNR. Those recommendations included a suite of six PFAS. They were based off of federal, the EPA set maximum contaminant levels for these six PFAS about a year earlier in 2024. Those recommendations, based on our state statute, our recommendations needed to follow there. So we took a look at the updated science and agreed. So we put forward our recommendations to match there. So I'll go over what those recommendations are.
Could I ask a quick question there? So this is for municipal drinking water systems, correct?
This is
not groundwater.
The EPA issued maximum contaminant levels, which are for municipal systems. Our recommendations are for groundwater, which have a much broader impact. So all drinking groundwater. If you have a private well, you are essentially your own municipal system. So our levels would be recommendations for those systems, for your private wells.
I'm confused because I know you're going through a rulemaking process to adopt the federal standards for municipal systems, but we still don't have groundwater standards in the state. So what is this recommendation for? Is there another rulemaking process going on for groundwater that I don't know
yes.
about? There is.
There are two,
thank you.
Yeah, there are two, NR 809, natural resources NR, those statutes cover municipal. There's one process undergoing for that, right. I believe. Then the groundwater standards are under NR 140, which is two separate rulemaking processes
thank
that
you.
Are undergoing. Along with those official recommendations, we also issued a number of health. We also changed a number of our health advisory levels, which are not going through the rulemaking process, but are still sort of action thresholds based on those. And I'll go over those shortly. So looking at the new recommendations we issued in cycle 12, there are a lot of big changes, I suppose. Two important changes are PFOA and PFOS The previous guideline for those was 20. All the units here are in nanograms per liter, which is equivalent to parts per trillion. The new recommendation, the new health threshold for those is 4 parts per trillion. We used to assess those in combination. So we'd look at PFOA plus PFOS and see if it exceeded 20. We no longer do that. Now we identify each individual one and isolate them. Besides PFOA and PFOS, there are also updates on the federal level for PFHXS, PFNA, HFCODA, or GenX, and PFBS. And those have all decreased down to 10 and 2,000, respectively. These are, especially PFOA, PFOS, and PFHXS to a slightly lesser degree, are the chemicals we're seeing the most often as the driver of health-based concerns, and they do have the most stringent recommendations. I can keep going. Like I said, we're gonna have time for questions after, so I can. There are no cards in the back, I believe, no cards outside that can take notes on and bring those up later or perhaps. And then secondly, the health advisory levels. These are all specifically, we updated the health advisory levels for 4 of the precursor compounds. When certain PFAS are out in the environment, sometimes they do break down into different versions of PFAS. These 4, FOSA, NETFOSA, and NETFOSI, all tend to degrade down into PFOS or PFOA. So subsequently, we have also lowered our health advisory level, our health guideline for these down to that 4 parts per trillion. And again, similarly to how we broke up the sum of the PFOA, PFOS, these are no longer assessed in cumulatively, they're all assessed individually. We are still using a cumulative approach for all the other PFAS. Part of the reason we separated out the cumulative approach for PFOA and PFOS is because some of their health thresholds were set based on cancer levels, potential for cancer. And it's a much longer toxicological explanation I'm not going to get into, but typically you don't sum together cancer and non-cancer guidelines when you're looking at them. It's just different types of math that don't make sense when combined. So the threshold of 4 is effective for both. Again, before the rest of them, we still do compare each individual PFAS against the health guideline, sum up all of those fractions, and then compare against the threshold of 1. So this is a summary slide of all of our current health guidelines for PFAS in groundwater and water. We have the PFOS and the PFOA and their precursors, all assessed individually against 4 parts per trillion, and then all of the other guidelines for health advisory levels for other PFAS, assessed both individually and. So, pivoting away a little bit now, just to talk about a reminder about some of the current consumption advisories that we have and about a recent one that just came out. There are a number of existing fish advisories, fish consumption advisories, both for Green Bay and major tributaries, including the Peshto River, up to the first dam. I know this is a little bit small. All this information is available on the DNR website. They have a Choose Wisely page that explains, you can go and search for the specific water body that you're looking in. But there are a number of advisories for different fish. A few are based on PFOS, many are based on polychlorinated biphenyls, which is a different persistent organic pollutant that accumulate in fish. There are also separately some specific advisories for the Menominee River based on mercury levels that were found there. These are all existing. Nothing here has changed recently. There is still a do not eat advisory for deer liver for any deer harvested within a 5-mile radius of Marinette. In the study, when they were looking at this, the levels in deer tissue and deer muscle were low, and we did not have we didn't have any indication that an advisory was needed. And lastly, the new advisory that just was just issued a few two weeks ago or so was for waterfowl ducks in the Bay of Green Bay. Closer down towards the city of Green Bay, there's a do not eat advisory for mallards. These are PFOS-based advisories, and it looks like right on the slide. And then for the rest of Green Bay, from sort of Longtail Point up to Marinette across to Sturgeon Bay, is that advisory reach. There is a recommendation to eat no more than one meal per month of mallards and one meal per week of wood ducks harvested in that area. So that is sort of the update. Those are the updates I have. I will certainly be around to answer any more questions afterward. But my contact information is there.
Can I ask a question?
Can you want to say it? Can you write it down? We can address it.
I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Thanks, Nathan. All right. So, pivoting a little bit now to get more specific to things going on more immediately here, as Nathan talked through. One of the primary concerns is exposure through consumption or drinking water, in this case, the primary where people might be exposed in this area. And so this has been a focus as well, to understand what private drinking wells have been impacted, and then to try to take steps to make sure that a safe drinking water source is provided when those wells are impacted. So this focus will be more on that specific aspect of things, and then we'll get into some more of the updates on the broader investigation. So when we talk about the private drinking water impacts here, there are three areas that things have been categorized and broken down into over time as we talked about things. So first off, we have, if you're looking on the right side of your screen, these are areas in the town of Peshtigo specifically. So we have that orange or brown shading is the portable well sampling area. And this is an area where JCI Tyco has accepted responsibility and is taking some action. Stepping out from there, we have a broader area in the town of Peshtigo, the Expanded Site Investigation Area, or the ESIA. And then stepping out even further as we go kind of northwest of Marinette, are areas around the biosolids land spreading fields. And this is areas where private wells were tested because they happen to be in proximity to where biosolids that had come from the city of Marinette had been potentially placed. And the concern being that JCI Tyco's industrial operations that contain PFAS could have passed through the water treatment plant and impacted these areas. So that's why wells in that location were tested. So when we talk about the updates in terms of what's happening, they're a little different in each area, so we're going to look at each individually here. So first off, just want to kind of think about how those lowering of the health guidelines that Nathan talked about changes how we are evaluating and seeing how many wells are impacted in each of those areas. So most of the sampling and work to evaluate issues was done in that 2020 time frame, give or take several years around there, but several years ago. At that time, the results of all that testing would have been compared to the previous health guidelines. And in each area, you can see a breakdown here going down here of how many private wells exceeded those guidelines that were approved.
Now with the lowering of the outers, we're seeing that additional wells being an impact of the PFAS above the new state health advisory levels. So something in that 27 to 37 range we saw previously, now we're seeing an increase of 40 to 50 additional wells impacted in each of those areas. And so the real crux is trying to then make sure that safe drinking water is provided where those impacts are. So we're going to go through what those actions are in each area, and then we'll start with the PWSA. And this is the area for JCI Tyco has been providing a response, and the primary action over the last few years is the offer of the provision of installing a new well. So we'll be talking through this in depth. So in the PWSA, where kind of are our numbers at these days? So in terms of people that have selected to receive a new deep well, we're at about 134 wells have been installed, and there's a few more to go. We're quite done, maybe estimating around 140 when all is said and done with people that have signed up for agreements to do so. Other people have opted to keep their original well, so of those, some of them are impacted with PFAS. So in that situation, there are 9 months that have a point of entry treatment system. So this is treating to remove PFAS from that original well. And then there are others that still have their original well, maybe that were not impacted with PFAS at this point, so have opted just to stay the course that way. And others maybe had PFAS impacts, but for various reasons, maybe are just selecting bottled water or other things, but by their choice. So this is sort of where the numbers are at in terms of moving towards different safety cleaner solutions to find in this area. So, why deep wells? Why was this sort of the avenue that's been moved down against that typo? So this schematic here is just a kind of rough sketch of what's happening underground in the area. And originally, many wells up here were completed more in that upper sanitary zone. In the upper, maybe somewhere at the same place, maybe 20 feet or some deeper up to 150 feet. But all completed on that sort of upper zone. And it's in that zone that we know PFAS impacts are present in certain areas. So, picking water from an area that is not impacted with PFAS was the solution pursued. And so, a deeper well in this case is one that was put down close to like 500 feet, depends on the location. And that is now pulling water from a deeper bedrock sandstone aquifer. So all these wells that have been installed are being tested. All that have been tested have been found to not be impacted with PFAS. So this is the good news. They also wanted to make a note that they're all installed also with a special well casing. So this is a deep casing that's sealed off, designed in a special way so that that contaminated water that's in that shallower zone doesn't move down into that deeper zone. So it's a more robust way of building a well than typically would be done for the purposes of protecting that lower aquifer. So, good news was, yes, not impact of PFAS. Now, we knew from the get-go that in this area of the state, that lower sandstone aquifer does have naturally occurring contaminants. In this case, the primary one being radium, also has strontium. It's also very hard water, so some people might not find that very aesthetically pleasing, but that does in their home. So, all the deep wells that have been installed have been tested for these things as well to understand what's going on there. And indeed, no surprises. They all, in most cases, had elevated levels of all these particular naturally occurring contaminants, radium, strontium, some of the harmless issues. So in this case, then, each of the deep wells have received a treatment system. This includes some filtration and water softening to address those harnish issues. And then under the sink, kind of at that point of use where most people are getting their drinking water, is a reverse osmosis system. And so this is to address some of those reusable strontium issues. Once that water has been treated, also is being tested. And the results show that the treated water is indeed safe to drink. It's meeting all the criteria or below that thresholds that we're making it less safe to begin with. So, also good news, but the thing to keep in mind is in order for that water to continue to be safe is that those treatment systems have to be kept up in order for the harness, the rating, and those issues to be addressed. Treatment needs to be maintained long term. So
that's where we go.
Yeah.
Yes. I've noticed if you're facing towards the camera, the sound is a little bit more clear for those of us on Zoom.
So this way.
Yes.
Sorry, folks.
Okay.
I'll do my best. My voice isn't very loud to begin with. So maybe if I kind of, can you see me still over here?
I can't see you, but maybe Duncan can move the camera.
Well, I'll just like do a little. None of us are like technology savvy. We're doing our best here. We gave ourselves like 2 hours to set up. Hooking it all up is not our expertise. You can see it on that one screen. Okay. Great. Thank you. Okay, so where we're at. I guess that sort of is the where things are at with regard to deep wells. Things are kind of wrapping up with the current agreements they've had, so we anticipate interacting with JCI Tyco in the coming months to kind of figure out what's next. So we don't have what their proposal or longer term plan is. That will be coming, but for the time being, they're wrapping up this action to get deep wells installed for those people that wanted that. So then that moves us into the expanded site investigation area. This is the area where DNR had conducted testing to assess if there were impacts to wells if they didn't put out bottled water. And the update to note here is that additional wells are now, or additional households that is, have qualified to receive bottled water from the state. And what I mean by that, qualified, is that the DNR is only authorized and able to provide bottled water when there is a drinking water advisory. So with that lowering of those guidelines, now additional wells qualify. So in that case, we're able to extend that offer to additional households. So no new testing per se has been done. It was just that change in those health guidelines that gave us that authority and authorization to provide more people with water. So those mailers went out to folks back in the spring, and many people have opted to sign up to get water. So the other update then is in, I realized I was talking to my friends over here, so try to project over this way so that the people on Zoom can hear better. The update for the biosolids area is similar, letting folks know that the DNR has been able to extend an offer and provide drinking water to bottled drinking water to additional households in this area. In this case, JCI Tyco had done sampling in that 2020 time frame and has been giving bottled water to people up there based on both testing results as well as if for certain households if they were just in proximity to these fields. And that water will continue. That will not change. Continuing to give those folks water. However, through various interactions, they've informed us that they are not going to be taking additional actions at this point, meaning that once those advisories levels went down, there were certain households whose wells were above that are not, were not receiving bottled water from them. And so through the course of all this, the DNR was able to do so. So it was actually just last week, September 2nd, we mailed out to 44 households the opportunity to sign up for bottled water from the state. And we're starting starting to get some in from this area as well. So that's the primary update or change happening there. All right. So that kind of the updates we have to share is cutting off that pathway of consuming, making sure people are not consuming PFAS impacted drinking water. So then we get kind of more focused on closer in Marinette and the facilities sort of area where we have higher levels of contamination, and thinking about the investigation and the cleanup steps that are happening here. So as we go through this, this will be some updates of what has happened, as well as some kind of refreshers of what we knew before and how we're building on that. So in the in this Marinette area focus again. Reminder, the two primary sources were JCI Tyco Stanton Street facility, where there was various manufacturing processes to produce AFFF, as well as the FTC property, where AFFF research, testing, and training activities occurred. The activities resulted in these PFAS going infiltrating into the ground in each of those areas. Once in the ground, it's moving with the groundwater, working its way slowly towards the Mississippi River, Bay of Green Bay, and sometimes it even gets kind of pulled back into some of these drainage ditches that are present in the community, and moving kind of more at a quicker pace towards the Bay of Green Bay. So we have a general sense of what's going on, but the details matter. So an investigation to figure out the size and shape of the problem, where things are moving, are really important. You can't solve a problem, right, unless we understand it. So the goal through all this is to be able to mitigate the harmful effects, restore the environment to the extent practical. So it's going to be a long process, but some more work has happened, so I'll share some of those updates. So since we were last here, one of the primary ways that we understand what's going on underground in the groundwater is through monitoring wells, wells placed underground to tell us what the concentration is, where the water is moving. All these little colorful dots on this map, not important details, but that these are representing where a monitoring well has been constructed in this community in order to kind of understand what's happening. And there were some 60 or so additional wells that have been added over the last 3 years or so. So at this point, there's about 100 monitoring wells in the monitoring program. This is to say that it's done. There's some details and things that, as we learn more, become important to track down in different areas. But a more robust monitoring network is in place. And this helps us, kind of see what the thing is today. But remembering, once these wells are in place, it's really helpful because you can go back to them and say, oh, how is it changing over time? Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? Is it moving over this way? So having this network helps us answer those questions. Can you change the screen? There's an issue up there. How are you doing? The goal of all this is to kind of say, what's the picture about what's happening underground?
You're seeing the presentation.
Okay. Sorry, everyone.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
About what's happening underground. We do a lot of, take a sample at a point and make some interpretations. So these next two images are taken from JCI Tyco's recent reports that have some idea of the interpretation that they're making about what's happening up here. So this particular one is a slice, basically looking through the ground down. Starting on your left is the FTC site, and then we're moving towards Menominee River under the Stanton Street site. And the important thing to think about is when we're talking about monitoring wells at points on a map, there's also lots of different depths that they're analyzing. So it's something that might be at the 5 to 15 feet, something might measure something going on at 20 or 30 feet, something at 50 or 70. Lots of differences happening. So it's a lot of different information coming to form this picture. And the big takeaway, I think, here is to note this darker blue area. This is impacts in the groundwater that are above 10,000 parts per trillion. As Nate was talking about, these thresholds that we're talking about unsafe for drinking water are closer to 4 parts per trillion PFOA. These are at 10,000, so very high. The good news is this isn't somewhere where there's an actual drinking water well in this location, but it's very important that this higher level of contamination be addressed so that the problem doesn't spread and get worse elsewhere, and that we can again mitigate those harmful effects. So when we think about other maps that we're going to be looking at, when we look at the maps kind of at the surface of what's going on, we like to make sure we're thinking about what depth is that contamination looking at. So this red line that I've drawn here is going to be the depth at which we're kind of projecting what's happening below ground on some maps that JCI Tyco has presented in their report. So this groundwater isn't groundwater that's right at the surface or a little bit down. It's usually something in the closer to like 20 to 50 feet down is what's being represented on the next few slides. That darker blue area, similar to what we're looking at when we had a slice foreground, is this higher concentration, about 10,000 parts per trillion. And as we step out, the rings that go out are kind of lower concentration zones. And that outer zone is really interpreted as 4 parts per trillion. The big takeaways here are that this contamination is moving towards the Menominee River, towards the Bay of Green Bay. And in this case, some of the ditches in the area, the surface water ditches, are picking up some of that contamination. So it continues to move slowly in groundwater in some cases, but once in these ditches, it can move quite quickly into the open bay. So all these things in our understanding help us kind of think about where do we need to take some actions to fix the problem. When we look at these maps, if it's something you've been tracking or following the details, they're fairly similar over time. Like, they're not looking very different. Maybe some fine-tuning here or there. And that's because the changes in the groundwater are going to be very, very slow. It's going to be decades for these changes to really occur. But some of the finer details do matter. So if you see this little, there's the ditch beacon running from the northwest southeast, and the darker blue plume in there. But we can see sort of this jetting out to the little line that comes past it. And that's an area where we've been seeing some increasing concentrations. And this is something we keep an eye on. Why is that happening? Is something getting away from us? Is there some more response action that has to happen?
So while big picture it's looking the same, there are some finer details that we keep an eye on as we look at things here. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. So, some pictures of what's going on underground. Not a lot of significant changes from recent years, but better understand where we are at. Now we also have discussion of surface water. So, talking about the fact that most of this contamination below ground, some of it may not get cleaned up in the surface water. And so we're also able to sample those locations to understand what's happening there. So on this picture, those red triangles represent different areas where JCI Tyco is collecting samples. And there are a variety of ditches, again, labeled for purposes of discussion here, A, B, C, through E. And we have two concentrations shown on the figure. One is things back in the 2018 timeframe when things were just getting started in the investigation, and then concentrations more recently, 2024, 2025. The big takeaway, I think, from here is to look at in the ditch A and ditch B areas. Those concentrations used to be above the 1,000 and are now more in the hundreds. A lot of that has to do with some of the cleanup activities that are occurring that we'll talk about. So these are continued to be monitored. So all these locations are part of a long-term monitoring program. We're continuing to track changes, but a couple of areas we're starting to see some difference here. All right, so and the whole point of understanding the problem is to try to take mitigate harmful effects, restore the environment. And so, some of the things that have been happening. Back in the early days when the higher contamination was discovered in the ditches, JCI Tyco had put on treatment systems on ditch A and ditch B. These essentially were siphoning off water from the ditches, treating it, trying to help remove PFAS from the water treated, and then putting it back into the ditch. Helpful in the sense that it can decrease some of the PFAS concentrations in surface water, but not perfect because it can't collect all of the surface water from in there. So, as more is understood, the fact that we now understand that it's mostly this contaminated groundwater that's kind of being pulled up into the ditch that's causing this problem, JCI Tyco has come forward and put in the groundwater extraction and treatment system for the GETS. That was put in 2022. The goal of that, again, is to help kind of reduce the amount of PFAS that's getting into the ditch B in the first place, cutting that off. So groundwater pumped from that area, instead of it going into ditch B, goes into a treatment system. As well as the fact that not all the groundwater is going to be going into the ditch. Some continues to flow and move on towards the river still. And so, it's also the goal of helping reduce the amount of PFAS that continues to migrate towards the river and groundwater. As we move along, the last few years, things have been evaluated and learned, and some improvements are being, or updates, if you will, to the GETS are planned. So in the process of making some modifications, those are happening right now, and we are getting put online this year. And the other thing I wanted to point out is we don't talk about it a lot, is that over at Stanton Street, this is a source of contamination as well, right on the Menominee River. This particular facility has a significant arsenic problem, and it historically had been a barrier wall, was sort of built around the facility to help control or limit the amount of groundwater that can even exit the facility. And that's helping to control the PFAS that can move as well. So we don't ignore this, it's definitely being monitored as well as some updates I'll talk about at the end of our plan there. But just to keep that in mind, that there's things happening there as well, so to try to minimize what's going into the Menominee River. So, the GETS, what's it doing? How's it been working? And then what are some of the results? So the GETS works in terms of at 9 extraction nodes, at least in its original configuration. These pump that highly contaminated groundwater, right? So that
10,000 part per trillion
CFOA, that higher mold contamination. It's pumped by these wells. It gets brought up, put through a treatment system, or goes through various filtration and processes. But at some point, it gets to go through some granular activated carbon and some resins, and that absorbs and takes the PFAS out of the water. That treated water is then tested. So the low detection, non-detection, but below pretty low thresholds in terms of the amount of PFAS in that treated water. Once the test goes back out into ditch B. So the stuff coming out of the ground, 10,000 parts per trillion PFOA, stuff being put back out into the ditch, is a much, much lower concentration. So that's all great in terms of like what the system does, but we really are caring about how does the environment respond? We're trying to restore the environment, the whole point of all of it. So where are we seeing some changes, where maybe is a So on this particular picture, we have a couple points on ditch B where monitoring is happening. One is that outlet going into the Bay of Windows, and one is further upstream. So again, remembering initially in 2018, so when we first started testing, things were above 1,000. So we did see some measurements in the 3,000. PFOA in the ditch. The ditch, the treatment system was installed in 2019, and that we saw some improvements from. It's really the guests that we hope to kind of set us on a better path. And so in 2022, that went online, and we're seeing that even upstream, the concentrations in the ditch no longer in that 3,000 parts per trillion range, now down into the 300 parts per trillion range. And as it moves out to the Bay of 100. All this is to say it still has impacts. It is not the end all be all, but an improvement is there. So we can work to kind of make refinements and adjustments to see if we can things can get better. The one thing I want to point out, because I know some people are interested always in these details, is that these three dates represent just like one point in time, and the surface water has a lot of fluctuations, lots of different stuff happening. So I have a more detailed graph on the next one. So I keep those three numbers in your head. So we've got in 2018 around 3,000, 2020 390, 2025 150. So those three numbers are also on this more detailed graph. And here you can see back early days, things were above get the ditch treatment system on, things hover now between 100 and 1,000. Not great, but better. The guest treatment system is on. Now we're hovering down more at these thresholds, which are our surface water criteria. So showing that these individual numbers don't represent everything, there's lots of variability, but the overall trend is in the right direction, so that's a good thing. So in terms of we're seeing the effects on ditch B. When the gas in these systems are working, they're also acting to take PFAS out of the environment. So how much PFAS have they removed? The graph on your left is the pounds of PFOA that have been removed since these systems started up. The blue line is the gas. The dashed line is ditch B. And then there's also a treatment system on ditch A. It's pretty minimal in those cases because there's not a lot of flow happening where the system is. But as of the time out period that these have been working, some 35-ish pounds of PFOA have been removed. Now, how much water does it take to remove that? It's a lot. So the graph on your right is millions of gallons. So the ditch B treatment system has removed over a billion gallons of water. That 1,433 is in millions of gallons. The Getz has pumped 281 million. So just thinking about that, it's a lot of water you have to get out of the ground and remove just to get at this 35 pounds. Once the horses are out of the barn, it's pretty hard to get them back in kind of velocity. So So it's a lot of energy and resources just to get to this phase, but work continues to be done there. So just keeping in mind how much water has to be treated just to get at this level. So we showed some of those like improvements of what's happening with the ditch B area. In terms of what's happening in groundwater, those changes are going to be a lot slower. So the graph on this picture here is showing what's the concentration that those wells that are being used to suck up groundwater near the guts pull in. Those concentrations have pretty much been around 10,000 parts per trillion PFOA from the time it started through today. So we're not seeing that there's a change happening there, and we wouldn't expect it to. The guess is really there just to sort of cut off what's flowing into ditch B. We don't expect to be treating the stuff coming, capturing anything more. So it's going to take a lot of time for this contamination to flush towards that, but it is helping to at least minimize what's getting away from the downgradient. As I mentioned earlier, that kind of bump out zone there on the graph, once you go past ditch B, we are seeing some increasing concentrations there, and that's something definitely we kept an eye on, and that's why there's some additional action happening for the guests, because that's telling us something more needs to get done there. Higher levels of contamination continue to migrate past. So, again, big picture there, but some of the details do matter, and we're keeping an eye on those things. So, coming this year, four new extraction wells are proposed up in that zone, so that's kind of that shaded area. And those are intended, again, to help further reduce how much is going into the ditch, as well as trying to capture more of that groundwater so it's not migrating further away. So these are just getting hooked up now. The response the environment will have, we just wait and see, but knowing that these things are being kept in mind. As well as a couple of extraction wells, more on the central part of the property are being proposed, so in two locations. The other thing, just to quick mention, is that the Stephen Street area does have this barrier wall that helps to limit how much water leaves the property to begin with. And there's definitely details that matter up there, too. So some improvements and refinements are happening up there, as well as a concept of a pilot extraction well to start to capture more of the groundwater that's outside of that wall from going into the river. So more to come on that, but things being thought of that way as well. So that's really where things are at in terms of where the investigation and cleanup status. For some of you, it may feel like it sounds pretty similar, and it's true. Takes quite a bit of time for us to see changes, but things are moving along at least at some pace. So with that, I think that's the end of the listening to me and Nathan. Now you guys will open it up to questions. So Christine, do you want to kick us off the Q&A part of things?
Sure.
And then open there?
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm Christine.
So
if you could all please raise your hands, that would help. If you're shy and you don't want to ask your question in front of everyone, you can have Doug do it. Or no, just write your questions down on note cards, and I would be happy to walk one over to you, or any of us could walk note cards over. And you have one, so we'll take that. For those of you who are joining us on Zoom, thank you for joining us. You can submit your question in the chat. That will go to the DNR host, who is Corrine. She works in the Remediation Redevelopment Program as our outreach coordinator. You can also use the raise hand function, and I believe that Corrine will be able to take you off of mute. She can unmute you. If you're on the phone, joining us by phone, you can do *9 to raise your hand in that way, or *6 to unmute when you're prompted. We do hope that we can leave this to 3 minutes per person, any questions 3 minutes per person, because I'm really happy to have a lot of people here. We didn't know what to expect, but there are many of you, and I would imagine you have questions. So we want to make sure that we can answer as many as possible. And I'm not going to remind you to keep it constructive, because I know that you do that. So, Jeff, you're going to get us kicked off.
I'm going to get you kicked off, and first of all, Christine, I'm glad to see you guys got the band back together after 27 months, and you're here, and welcome to the City of Marinette, Aldermanic Ward 3. I would be the alderperson, which is the most contaminated area in the City of Marinette, and we are on top of that contamination. Also want to welcome State Senator Mary Belzkowski, also Senate President, and our State Senator in District 12. Thank you for coming today. I just really want to make one point that I think is real important, because we just finished talking about the GEM system. The contamination that's underneath this building, the contamination that's in the town of Cheshire, the contamination that is up by Stanton Street. The GET system isn't going to remove any of that. The GET system is going to take water from about a 2-square block area and treat it. And that's a good thing. It's going to help, and it has helped reduce some of the surface water contamination that's flowing into the Bay of Green Bay, although it still exceeds state standards. Still exceeds that surface water standard. But it is not going to return the groundwater where we are right now back to no PFAS. So we've got to keep in mind it's a mitigation process, it's not a remediation process. It's not returning the groundwater to what it was before it got contaminated. If you disagree, please say so.
I think I've got it right. You do. Jeff. Will new PFAS surface water standards impact the requirement for treatment of any of the other ditches, C, D, and E?
I mean, there's not any new surface water standards?
Well, the ones that have been enacted for PFAS. I think it was a 6 or 7 year rollout of them.
I'm not aware of a rollout. As soon as they were promulgated and passed through code, they became effective and applicable to discharges. So we're currently working on issuing an individual permit that covers each of the ditch systems under one pollutant discharge permit. Right now, the ditch, there's 2-3 ditch systems that are covered under general permits because we didn't have a great mechanism when all of this was discovered to cover them. So that's more of a procedural issue on our end. Now that we have the standards that have been passed, those will be used and applied in the directing of the individual permit that will have each of the ditches covered as separate outfalls or separate sources laid out in the permit. And then they'll each have their own set of limits that would have to be applied.
But again, like I saw a ditch, I don't know if it was E or D, there's 590 parts per trillion going through that ditch into the lake. So will be there any more treatment on the other ditches required?
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Based on the standards, the new standards for surface water for PFAS.
Yeah, so in when we're thinking about all those ditches, we really focused on the 2 big ones, but there are other ones draining the water in the area. In general, most of the time they are below the standards. Occasionally they do bump up, and we do keep an eye and monitor to see, is that a trend that's continuing, or is that just this one time and for the most part they're below? For the most part they are below, and so the resources to do something there wouldn't be, I think, probably likely the best in this case.
But they are being monitored to know, is that changing? Because if it does, that would be a different answer.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I have a problem with ditch, the creeks.
Yeah, I know. Water. Some of these names begin.
I have some property on ditch D.
Okay.
Creek D. It's right there, right on the bay. They put a new well in there. Mm-hmm. And my question is, it was like over 10 hours at the time. My son here lives on Heath Lane. He's got money from Tyco. He's got a lot of water. But his levels are pretty high, too. Little River runs right north of the river, east of the river, south. So I'm just wondering about my son, his well-being, what's going to happen with that. Now that's on the other side, of their their original, basically, which was ditch D or ditch D. Ditch D runs through my property, and I don't live there, but I have a place up there. They do well. But I'm just worried about my son.
Are you asking about his
private well, right?
Right.
He's
on Heath Lane. He's not that far away from. He's only two houses offshore drive from the bay.
Yeah. And has your well been tested?
Been tested, yeah.
And do they have
PFAS? Yeah.
And so are you getting water from?
Culligan right now.
Okay, so yeah, at this point, we're making sure at least people can drink water that is not impacted is the goal. And the option that the DNR is able to offer is Culligan bottled water. In terms of additional actions that can will happen from here, I don't know where the things will go. But in terms of today,
but isn't that what you're talking about here, about continually they're talking about expanding it maybe?
Yes, these are difficult questions to answer in terms of
right.
what those outcomes will be. So what you're looking for and what you would like is definitely a goal of all of us, but I don't know what the outcome or how things will transpire down that path to find resolution there.
But that's what we're talking about. Expanding things, depending on the PFAS in the ground.
Sure. So the ability to make changes and pivot as new information is learned is always something that we're after.
Because I know people that are farther out, on Shore Drive, that have PFAS. Now it's not as bad as East Lane or where I was, but still.
Yeah, I know it's not very satisfying right at this point for that answer.
I know my wife had thyroid disease. I don't know if she got it. We were out there quite a bit. We built a place out there. She got Parkinson's disease. So I don't know if that has something to do with it. Yeah.
We have sampled bald eagles several times over the course of the last 15 years for numerous contaminants, including PFAS. And the PFAS levels in those nestling bald eagles are pretty consistent with what we observe in other parts of Green Bay as well as West Michigan. And so we do not believe that they are impacting their reproductive success at all. Whether or not PFAS is impacting other aspects of their health is something that we're still working on.
And Sean, you're our wildlife toxicologist for the DNR, right?
And fish, don't forget
and
that.
And fish, okay. I just wanted to make sure.
All the above.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
So in terms of percentage of water that goes to the guests, I think we have an understanding of like the total flow of groundwater going past there, how much is actually being captured. Those volumes, those metrics aren't something that has been provided to us in terms of a calculation. So it's definitely, you're correct to ask the question that the Getz is not capturing all the groundwater in that area. It's simply reducing the amount of groundwater that can move past it. So how much of that is happening is not a number that we have a ability to say it's this percentage of the groundwater.
Is it a small amount? Is it a significant amount?
I'm not sure how I would answer that. I mean, it's a designed amount in order to not over pump. We don't want to drop down so much that there's too much water being pumped in the area. So it's a balancing kind of approach, which is part of the reason I say it's kind of continuing to be looked at. Is the goal is to reduce how much PFAS gets into the ditch or moves away, and so those things we are making sure get monitored very closely, and when they aren't working perfectly, then we're saying, oh, more needs to happen. But at some point, it would be maybe enough. But the amount of the water isn't necessarily something we've been like provided with that information. But the outcomes, like what we're expecting to see, is what we're really focused on at this point. So I don't have a direct answer to your question, but in terms of what you're thinking about is right, more might need to get.
So ditch D has an increase of contaminant?
The one that you were looking at.
So,
yeah.
So, and you're adding some additional guest systems? Is there a reason not focusing on that area where it's increased before it goes into the bay?
Oh, sure. So this is thinking back to some of that, those surface waters that were going through. And this was getting at Jeff's question, too, is that those fluctuate quite a bit, so I was trying to be fair and capture like one point in time that was consistent amongst all those. It doesn't happen to be higher, so it does show that it fluctuates higher, but most of the time it is not at an elevated level that would be above the surface water standards. So we continue to keep an eye on that one because it does bump around and there might need to be something done, but it's not sustained all the time. Whereas ditch B before is a
is the bay in that area still captured?
So the question is whether the bay itself has been tested. So yes, Green Bay and the Menominee River surface water has been tested by JCI Tyco in a variety of areas. The levels are not elevated once it gets into those large surface water bodies, mostly because of dilution. These are very large surface water bodies. Still don't want to see that resource receiving all this contamination. But in terms of the measured levels out there today, they are not elevated.
So they're below the surface water standard?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Is that your recommended 4 parts per trillion?
Yeah, and the surface water in the Bay of Green Bay, drinking water sources, right now it's at 20 parts per trillion. It's the criteria for surface water.
Yeah. All right, let's sit in the room. Go ahead.
Good kind of to piggyback on the gentleman's concerns in front of me in the Heath Lane area, I'm in also in that expanded area and thankful for the DNR to supply me with bottled water. And I guess it might not be a question for this group, but you know, being we're in a contiguous area with the plume, well, how is it not determined that this is a Tyco issue? Where is it just, is there no, I mean, how did the Tyco plume was established and now there's an expanded area.
Yeah.
How is it that that expanded area is not Tyco's concern?
Well, I'm looking at Duncan because he's not actually our IT person. He's actually our attorney who's assigned to the case. And I should introduce him anyway because he's a member of the team behind the scenes. But I think I can do this. I'm going to feel his eyes in my head. So that's a point that the DNR and JCI have been in disagreement on over time. We've said we think that they haven't defined degree and extent of the plume, and they feel that they're taking care of all of the contamination that that they caused. So that is that's a point of contention, and we are in active litigation, and so there are some things that we're not going to probably say too much about. But that's one of the things that's kind of fundamental in all of this, that we have that disagreement on whether or not they've met their responsibilities as outlined in the site investigation portion of the state code.
Okay.
We're not trying to be cagey. I do want to say that too. Sometimes we really don't have answers, but sometimes there are just things that
are in process.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Jeff?
I have two questions, actually. Right now, we're going through legislation. They're trying to push for a groundwater standard of 20 parts per trillion. When the drinking water standard right now is at 0.4 parts per trillion. And Wisconsin Manufacturers Commerce wants to keep it at 70 parts per trillion. They're fighting us in the legislation right now to keep it at 70. Now, how can we establish a groundwater standard at 20 when the drinking water standard is at 0.4? We're still drinking poison water well exceeded beyond the parts per trillion, and how can they get away with that? Another question I have is, I live outside the plume zone. My neighbors, I just recently got their well tested. I live on Range Road. My well has been poisoned for I don't know how many years now. Is there going to be any type of test wells that are going to be monitoring our area outside that plume zone with all my other neighbors that are being poisoned by this water? It's in the aquifer. My well is well over 100 feet deep. It's in the aquifer. How come there's not been no testing out in that area, looking at all the, there's ditches that run along the, hypothetically by the Porterfield Music Fest. I took stuff from Stouffville, Tom Pearson's last couple years ago for a testing of the creeks. We tested the foams that came out of there, and they were outrageous coming from those groundwaters and by Strutz's and all these other different farms out there. How come there's no testing or monitored test wells out in that area, testing the water that's coming through all of our wells out in that area?
Well, in your area, you're not within that biosolids area.
Yes, I am.
But not in the area where we've named, correct, that Johnson Controls as a responsible party. I know that there are biosolids where you are, but there is an area where 6-7 years ago we named Johnson Controls as a responsible party, and that's where they went then and tested drinking water in that limited area around fields where we know there were sludge spread that potentially had their defects, and they've been providing water to some of those people. Under the law, they should also be starting an investigation and exploring what they're doing here in the Biotechnology Center. And to date, that hasn't happened.
Okay.
And just remember, we've talked about this, but it's been a couple of years, that in this case, JCI, that has to follow the law, that sort of cookbook in state law that tells them how to get from reporting to immediate and interim action.
Doug's point, to investigation, to remedy, selection, and hopefully eventually cleanup, and someday down the road, case closure. And so it's not the Department of Natural Resources that does that work. That's not the role that was given to the DNR 47 years ago by the legislature. So it's our role is to make sure and to help, to try to help people to follow the law, but we're not outputting monitoring wells in by and large, because we don't have the resources to do that. And that's not, we don't have the resources to do that. That's the primary reason.
So our legislation right now is pushing for a 20 parts per trillion when it's at 0.4. So our legislation, our government legislation, is actually protecting the corporate polluters that are killing our people in our area by having a 20 parts per trillion drinking water standard when the EPA recognized it at a 0.4. You know, what's wrong with our legislation? Why ain't the legislation protecting the people they're supposed to be representing? They're not. They're protecting the corporate polluter that's polluting us and making disease all over our state. Where's our legislation, may I ask, putting a stronger parts per trillion drinking water standard, a lower drinking water standard? We are here in this room, we are all getting poisoned by the corporations. These corporations have made billions and trillions of dollars off the backs of our environment, on the backs of our health and welfare. Why ain't our legislation picking up the price to protect us from this? It's sad that we have to come here and fight for us. Where's our representatives? We have one right there. Can she answer any of the questions? I don't think so. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Chuck. Go ahead.
First of all, I would like to thank the department for bringing a good crew of people out here to put us up to date what's going on. It's really important. But so much of what we're talking about today is mandated by legislation. And the Department of Natural Resources doesn't make the law and regulations. So I guess I would like to ask our representative senator from our area to tell us what she is doing to ensure that the department has sufficient funding to increase the monitoring and help us remediate this problem.
So the department is funded to do this. We had a bill last year, it was vetoed.
Can you speak up, please?
Yeah, can you hear me?
So last year we had a bill on PFAS that put aside $125 million that was vetoed. This year, we have money set aside, and Senator Rimberger and Jeff Marisar are the lead on it, and right now they're in negotiations with Governor Evers so that we don't go through the veto process again to try to get a negotiated bill to come out around the PFAS issue again. And as far as the bill, we run up on the groundwater standards. We run up against the RAINS Act. And the RAINS Act is a law in the state of Wisconsin that any rule or bill that causes more than a certain dollar amount in order to enforce has to go through the legislature. And we are actively up north trying to fight, because this is only one of the contaminant areas in the 12th Senate District. And yes, you have 10,000 parts per trillion. I have the town of Stella that has 47,000 parts per trillion. And at this point right now, we can't pinpoint where it came from. Okay?
Even in Rhinelander right now has a very high concentration of
PFOA. Thomas Stella is right outside the city of Rhinelander.
And there's lakes that are polluted by this. There's a lot of different areas that are polluted.
And most of the people right now won't even test their wells because they're afraid to find out.
Why can't you, each chemical has a ribbon. You can take those chemicals and you can tell exactly where that chemical was made. How come you are not testing them, where that PFOS is coming from? Like I said prior, each chemical has a certain chemical ribbon.
So I personally am not doing it. I know that the department is working hand in hand with the town of Stella, and they're working on that right now. So the Rhinelander paper mill, we have a whole bunch of different things that went on up around the Rhinelander area. A lot was put into the Rhinelander dump sites and the landfills up there, and a lot of the companies that they think this is attributable to are bankrupt and no longer there. So all that is being investigated right now. Rhinelander's in the process of trying to get the permits and the financing, and they're working through it right now. Along our office is helping them, along with Representative Swearingen, to get the money to put in new wells, because two of their wells are now defunct. So
because they were drilled right next to the landfill. One of the city's wells were drilled right next to the landfill. I talked to the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
what do you expect when you would put a well next to a landfill with the seep?
Somebody gave them a permit to do that. That's not why we're here, and that's not what we're arguing about. So we are working, MRSA's working on getting, trying to get the standard. But keep in mind, and I want you to remember this, it's not like we're not fighting for you. I represent 10 counties up here. My counterpart to the west of me has 11 counties. There's 6 senators in the city of Milwaukee. They don't have PFAS issued on there. It's not on the radar. We're fighting as hard as we can for you. We understand that this is. I've got PFAS all over up here.
You're correct.
Cindy, I want to thank you for being here. That does mean a lot. It shows that you're invested in this. We've met with you several times before, so I applaud you for that. The one thing that I would ask you to keep in mind, it's been brought up a couple times, and it's a complicated thing if you don't live and breathe this like several of us do. The RAINS Act is the devil in the details. You can go through the 30-month rulemaking process, as we've done multiple times, and it gets undone, completely roadblocked by the RAINS Act. Here's where you have influence, because you're the president of the Senate. Either create some legislation that provides an exemption around the RAINS Act, or PFAS, because this is a contaminant like none other we've ever experienced. It does not, it should not be constrained by the same structure that the RAINS Act was originally created for. And if you aren't willing to go that far with it, you and others, I don't mean this to be targeted at you, then the RAINS Act is the barricade that can stop forward action, right? But it can also be ignored. It can be overridden. All it takes is the will of the legislature. Right? So that's important for the public to understand that there are pathways forward. You're right, you do need to get consensus. I'm guessing that a lot of the elected officials down in the cities that you were talking about, if there's legislation that's going to be presented, I would bet they're going to sign on. And I'm glad that we have, you know, this is so sick for me to have to say that I'm glad that there are enough impacted communities that we have elected officials on both sides of the spectrum. Been saying it for 8 years, PFAS doesn't discriminate.
No.
And we all have to work together on the solution. And the funding is there, and so we have to release it, right?
Jeff, I'm gonna switch over here again. Go ahead.
I guess I'm looking for advice. I'm in the process of building my forever home. Last year when I purchased my property, I was told we do not have PFAS. by Matt Coleman. I'm sure a lot of you know that name. He's with Tyco. Of course, I don't believe what half of the people say, so I have a small pond on my property. Granted, I know surface water is different than water below the surface. I sent it to the laboratory of hygiene, and it came back at almost 9 parts per trillion of PFOA. Everything else is good, but the A is one of the worst ones. So I guess I'm looking for advice. I'm $250,000 into my project already. I have to do a well. I contacted him. He said if that PFAS wasn't from us, it was from one of the paper mills, which is a crock. It's not from a paper mill that's 5 times further away than the JCI. My property is right behind the new hospital. My neighbor got a well. Now, do I risk the chance of putting in my own well and paying for it and then testing it and then finding out that I have PFAS in my well? Or do I just seek counsel and go after them and pay for everything myself and keep track?
And you're not within the area where
he says I'm outside, but my neighbor, which is 50 yards away, just had a well put in.
I think Alyssa could talk with you after, and you can compare notes on your address. But Kyle, do you want to say anything about private water and well construction, or do you have anything to...
Yeah, I mean, thanks for your question. I think the first thing you want to do is confirm with us that you're outside of the area, right? And then the second thing, when it comes to constructing a private well, I believe that it's possible to drill a private well in this area that doesn't have PFAS in it. If we go into the deeper aquifer, like Melissa said, we may have other contaminant issues, naturally occurring contaminant issues and aesthetic issues. As a private well owner, you get to make that choice on how you want to drill your well. You could drill that deeper well and determine that you want to do some kind of treatment based on the results. You could drill a shallow well and treat the PFAS, either way. But as far as what your recourse is, now, I would make sure that you're not in a Tycho's area. If you're in the expanded site area, it falls into the conversation we had before. We're you know, in the process, we're working on it, where it's not something that we have the ability to answer now. So you have options. I mean, I don't think you have to have a reserve home without a well. There certainly are options there.
I mean, I've been given two different prices on wells, but a PFAS well was $35,000, where a standard well is $13,000.
And that's it. And then you could choose to drill that well, and then the whole thing would be or you could drill a deep well in that end. And then federal assess the water quality from there. Have it talk with you more offline.
Christine, before we move off of this topic, I did get a question that's
related. The question is, my family is going to move to the Marinette Menominee area, and we're in the process of looking for a home to purchase. Are there required disclosures for PFAS contamination concerns during the home sale process? Or how can we be most informed about the levels in a given location as we are looking for homes?
Well, we can't give real estate advice here. And there is a property condition report, and there are certain disclosures on that. And I think that person should work with their realtor or attorney to get some advice on that. That help?
All right, thank you. Okay. We have another question on Zoom.
Sure.
When you want to,
yeah,
do you want to stick there now?
Okay.
Andy, I'm going to ask you to unmute, and then you can ask your question.
Oh, are you still there?
Yep, good. We hear you.
Okay. So thank you for coming, Mary Felskowski. I'm really excited that you're here. And since you brought up Governor Evers and his veto memo states, and multiple reviews of the bill also confirm, that the bill that you proposed would have let Johnson Controls off of the financial hook for cleanup. And as you know, they have properly disposed of PFAS against the guidelines of their own safety data sheets for decades. And I know that you've gone out multiple times saying that, you know, the people need to help clean this up. And so considering that the people are, you know, doing a lot of sacrificing right now because of this mess that was made by them ignoring their own safety data sheets, Are you suggesting that Johnson Controls shouldn't help pay for the cleanup of this contamination when you draft legislation that would let them off of the financial hook? I mean, directly, do you think that the people of this community should bear the financial burden of the cleanup of this mess?
Absolutely not, and you're misconstruing 100% of what I said, and you're taking bits and pieces. So Governor Evers in his veto message said that the bill that we put out there would not have allowed the DNR to enforce the Spills Act, which we have from the bipartisan, nonpartisan legislative audit bureau, the
Legislative
Reference Bureau, thank you.
You're welcome.
The Audit Bureau, Reference Bureau, Fed, says that is absolutely 100% not true. That the bill that we had out there last year would have 100% allowed the DNR to enforce the Spills Act. 100% allowed the DNR to enforce the Spills Act. So that is 100% not true. What I have said over the years is that the size and breadth of the PFAS issue in the United States, because it is all over. What happened here is we know that Johnson Tyco is 100% responsible for the PFAS issue in Marinette, and they should be responsible for the cleanup. But when it comes to the PFAS issue that's across the United States, it's like the PCB thing that happened in the 70s. It's going to be a public-private partnership. There's no way that we are going to be able to 100% clean this up. And let me give you an example when I say that. And I'm going to go back, and I think it was 1920 when we had the fire at MG&E right outside Madison in the switching station. Is that like 1920? Okay, so there's a fire in Madison at the Madison Gas and Electric in one of their switching stations, which is right downtown outside the Capitol, within a block of the Capitol. They chose to use the firefighting foam that had PFAS in it to put that fire out, knowing that it had PFAS in it and that PFAS is harmful to people.
Did you say 1920?
Yes, 2020.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Oh, I was going to say, wow. Back then.
I
left
home at 6 a.m. 2020.
I apologize. Okay.
Right.
So they chose to do that, and they weighed the odds on it. What was going to be the worst? If that would have blown in downtown Madison? So that's where a public-private partnership is going to come in. PFAS up until like 4 years ago was still being used at a lot of our airports because they didn't have the alternative. It is going to be, in order to clean it up nationwide, it's going to be a public-private partnership. In the case of Marinette, Tyco was responsible for this. So Tyco should pay.
I just want to piggyback on that, Senator. We have, our local Tyco has its own wastewater treatment site, on site, where they can't get it down to zero, but have been permitted to send it down a sanitary sewer. Now, Warren's here from the water department. He should be able to speak to that. That'll end up being a partnership when they're doing it, knowingly doing it. And
well, who's giving them a permit to do that?
The city is.
The city did.
Yeah, right.
I don't know what to say to that.
That's an answer. That's where the complaint goes.
Right. Back to this side of the room.
This has to do with the residential testing by DNR. If you live just outside the critical zone, city can test less than 4 parts per trillion when the standard was 20, was relatively comfortable. Now that it's down to 4, and if you've got a test of 3 parts per trillion, is that going to be some expense that we have to pick up, or is the DNR going to check to say that that critical zone has it? In fact, that plume has in fact moved beyond the critical zone. Do you have any evidence of that happening, or is there going to be any evidence established to prove that there is a fact that the plume is essentially expanding?
And that's what we were talking about earlier, that's still in process. And that's part of what's being actively still litigated. So that's not something that I can speculate on. But you're asking about whether or not someone is going to come and test your well. Okay, and you were asking about costs for a well, and I know that Jeff's had concerns about treatment. And I think one thing I will say about the $125 million trust fund that Senator Falskowski was referring to is the department's hope is that I'll be positive and say when the money is released, when it becomes available, we hope that that's going to be available to help people and to help communities. So to help people with well construction and to help people get their well tested and find out whether or not it's contaminated with PFAS, and to help communities that are struggling with what to do about their wastewater treatment system or about their public wells. So I think I wanted to say that the $125 million that she was referring to is critical for this purpose. I hope that it's going to go directly to the people to help people.
So we're using our tax dollars of $125 million to clean up a corporate polluter pollution.
Jeff, I think this is a work in progress.
Yeah,
the DNR has been very focused And we've been upfront in our discussions on how that money, how we think the money should be used.
Okay.
Our focus is on public health. And let's just get that under control first. Let's find out who's drinking this and make sure they have safe water. Let's deal with that aspect, because I think that's critical. And I think the rest of these things, it's going to be a long time, and it's going to be a work in progress, and it's not going to happen the way we want it to. But we really, we've got to keep our eye on that prize of public health.
You know, I keep in mind, too, when this gets focused down to the point where we can say exactly and things are pinpointed.
Can you speak up, please?
We have an attorney general, and his job is to represent the state of Wisconsin when the state of Wisconsin is wrong. We have the opioid settlements. There's been lawsuits. We have an attorney here, like you could probably remind me of all the things of that lawsuits that have been filed. When those types of things happen, we have an attorney general that can go after people that have wronged the state of Wisconsin in certain instances. So those types of possibilities that are still out there to recover dollars that taxpayers have been spent. So those options, I'm not saying that it's going to happen tomorrow, but those are still some of the options that happen when you have situations like that. So yes, we're using taxpayer dollars right now because we have citizens that are hurting and that need the resources today. But that doesn't mean that down the road there won't be lawsuits filed against somebody like a Tyco or whomever, you know, if this situation would pop up in La Crosse. Or we have French Island. There's another situation in French Island, which is just north of La Crosse, right? So it isn't a done deal. Nothing is ever like done or closed off. There's still situations where money can be recovered and be used to help others.
And the Attorney General did file a lawsuit in 2020, and I think the aim of that is to get money to remedy the damage that's been done to the environment and the damage that's been done to our people.
There's multiple lawsuits. Two lawsuits that the Attorney General filed. One is specific to our area, on our contamination.
Right.
The second one is broader. It names a number of companies, but including Tyco Johnson Controls, for the contamination that occurred statewide from the use of firefighting.
Right. Home. And it recognizes that sometimes there will be site-specific issues and there's a site-specific lawsuit. You're correct. Sometimes there will be an issue in the environment. We're going to find this in the environment, and we're not going to have a responsible party to name. And so it's that damage to the natural resource that's the focus of the second lawsuit. And that that's also still being actively litigated. All right. Yes.
Well, I have two questions. First one, I know we're talking about drinking water and the health. Is there any research that's been done to say with bathing or coming through the skin? Is there any research that's been done?
Yes, there's been quite a bit done looking at the different ways we're exposed. By and large, the main way we are exposed is through ingestion of contaminated water, contaminated food, inhaling dust that might be contaminated. When PFAS is in water, the way it dissolves and the way it interacts with our skin means that not much PFAS is absorbed dermally. It doesn't get through. So it's a fairly negligible amount. Mostly when we are talking about things like swimming or bathing, we're more concerned about any sort of incidental ingestion that might come. Like if you're swimming in a surface water that has contamination, worried about that incidental ingestion from a PFAS perspective, but also from parasites and viruses and other breathing algae that show up in the water.
So what you're saying is it doesn't get absorbed through the skin?
It's a negligible exposure compared to the amounts that come in from ingestion.
Plus lots of gardens, grow vegetables, all various people still eat that.
Sure, so yeah, gardening is a so we do recommend that, and I have a sort of handout out there about backyard gardening. So PFAS is taken up into plants that we might be gardening with. Those exact specifics of all that are still very much being uncovered. We generally recommend that if you are doing gardening, you use water that has PFAS levels below our health thresholds. It's a fair bit more nuanced because different plants uptake it in different ways. It gets into some leafy vegetables, it gets into some roots, smaller